On Thursday, the 15th of May, The Spectator is hosting a live book club event. Sam Leith will be joined by former Telegraph editor-in-chief and military historian Max Hastings. It will be an opportunity to talk about Max's new book, Sword, D-Day, Trial by Battle, as well as mark the 80th anniversary of VE Day. The full details are as follows. 7:30 on Thursday the 15th of May at the Shaw Theatre in Euston, London, and tickets start from £27.50, although I believe there are ticket options that include a signed copy of the book. For those tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/bookslive. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite articles from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Alenka Hamilton ponders whether Poland's revival is a mirage. Melanie McDonough asks who killed the postal service. Hannah Moore argues that family cars aren't built for families anymore. James Dellingpole reviews Carême from Apple TV and Chef's Table from Netflix. And finally, William Atkinson provides his notes on Thomas the Tank Engine. Up first, Alenka Hamilton.
In 1988, when I was 6 months old, my British father and Polish mother took me to meet my family in Krakow. My parents brought an extra suitcase filled with disposable nappies because such luxuries weren't sold on the other side of the Iron Curtain. At the time, there was only one shop in Krakow that sold foreign goods, but my father was pleased to discover that a gallon of whiskey could be bought for only $8. He was a member of the House of Lords, and I'm told we were trailed for our entire stay. Everywhere we went, a large Polski Fiat 125, driven by a suited man, followed us. My parents always said that apart from drinking in people's homes, there wasn't a lot to do in Krakow back then. There were a couple of run-down cafes in the main market square, but that was it. Today, Krakow is unrecognisable from the grey, drab and depressing place it was in the 1980s. That same medieval square, the largest of its kind in Europe, now has 400 cafes and restaurants on and around its streets. Many of these serve extremely good quality food and drink, more Bordeaux than Bulgarian Sofia, and they are all full of tourists. The hotels are excellent, the streets are clean, and public transport is pristine and mostly punctual, unlike in Britain. International headlines are full of stories about Poland's economic revival and growing political importance. Warsaw's Stock Exchange benchmark index tops 100,000 points for the first time, said one newspaper last week, while another reported, Poland unveils plans to become major military power. The country's economy has doubled over the last two decades, growing faster than neighbouring Central European countries and at twice the average rate of other OECD countries. Within the EU, it lies only behind Germany, France, Italy, Spain and Holland in terms of GDP and is expected to overtake Britain in GDP per capita in the 2030s. Tom Leach is a British businessman from the Midlands who bought his first property in Poland in 2003. He visited Poland on an interrailing trip while at Oxford University and became so enamoured by it that he came back as soon as he had finished his degree. I felt Poland had so much to offer. It seemed incredibly good value for money, and I kind of assumed it would catch up relatively quickly with Western Europe, explains Leach, who set up Leach & Lang, one of Poland's first and best-known property consultancies. Poland was a kind of wild east back then, which made it fun starting up a business, he says, noting the strong work ethic, discipline and levels of education among its people. The business environment has professionalised considerably and become more transparent. Leach's instinct back in 2003 could not have been better. Poland joined the EU in 2006, which coincided with the rise in budget airlines. It made it easy and cheap for tourists to visit and for Poles to go and work abroad. Billions of euros of EU money came flooding in. Poland was the only country in the bloc not to have a recession in 2008. Part of Poland's investment appeal lies in the fact that it is not just reliant on one big city, as is the case with many other Central and Eastern European countries, Leach explains. Besides Warsaw, cities like Krakow, Wrocław, Gdańsk and Poznań, with populations of at least 500,000 each, are able to attract investors in their own right. Since the beginning of the Ukraine war, an influx of wealthy Ukrainians, American military families and international media have brought more money into the country. But many Poles consider their nation's prosperity to be nothing more than a mirage. A good businessman will make money in North Korea, says Matthew Kielanowski, a lawyer, former government advisor and Poland watcher. he points out that many of the most successful companies are foreign-owned. Such new wealth can vanish in days together with its owners. Less savvy businessmen, he says, are either cheated by the government or give up and leave, exasperated by the chaos. The police and the courts are corrupt, and the tax system is the most complex in the world, he says. Eva Korvinia is in her 60s and works as a German to Polish translator of literature. She has lived in Krakow her whole life and wonders who Poland's newfound prosperity is serving. Local Krakow is dead, she says. A cup of coffee now costs 20 zloty, the equivalent of £4, which is prohibitively expensive for most Poles. As a result, the cafes and restaurants are filled with tourists and wealthy Ukrainians, but few locals. Shops sell Polish pottery at prices only foreigners can afford. Both Korvinia and Kielanowski are scathing about Poland's supposed revival. Poland's so-called success is an optical illusion created by EU policymakers in cahoots with the Polish government, says Kielanowski. It serves to divert scrutiny from Western Europe's huge problems and to deliver praise and boost the morale of the Polish people. Poland is being prepared to be used as a buffer zone, if not a meat grinder, in any future conflicts in the region. Poland is suddenly more acceptable to global political elites, he says, thanks to the election of former EU chief Donald Tusk, along with his Oxford-educated foreign minister Radek Sikorski, the only Polish politician recognisable in the media abroad, Kielanowski says. Prior to Tusk's election as prime minister in 2023, the country had been ruled by the Law and Justice Party, which sought to promote traditional family values while also trying to pare back more liberal elements in the country's judiciary. Politicians in Brussels saw this as an attack on the rule of law and began cutting off EU funds while imposing fines of 1 million euros a day. Poland was often treated as something of a rogue state within the European Union. Tusk only beat Law and Justice thanks to a coalition among left-wing parties, so desperate were they to remove a popular conservative government. Law and Justice still received the highest number of votes of any party in 2023. In just over a week, the country will vote again, this time for the president, the second most powerful politician in Poland. While the Prime Minister oversees the day-to-day running of government, the President has a veto and acts as the Commander-in-Chief, a more powerful position since war came to the country's eastern border. The presidential election is being fought between Tusk's candidate, Rafał Trzaskowski, and Conservative independent candidate, Karol Nawrocki, supported by the Law and Justice Party. He is unable to officially stand for the party because he is head of the Commission to Prosecute Historic Fascist and Communist Crimes. During the election campaign, there has been plenty of talk of more military spending, much of which is covered excitedly in the Western press. Inside Poland, the presidential election is seen as something of a referendum on the EU. Unsurprisingly, Tusk wants a stronger relationship with Brussels, while conservatives believe that the war in Ukraine has demonstrated the importance of national sovereignty. Poland's politics can still confound Western observers. Tusk's progressive candidate, for example, argues for further deregulation and cuts to welfare, while the Conservatives are the ones who want to keep Poland's legacy of welfare intact. Many Poles believe that the country is losing a certain vitality, particularly in the way children are raised. The only great thing about communism, says Kielanowski, was that the education was excellent. There was compulsory free education at every level, huge curricula covering literature, music, sports, arts for everyone. He laments that the current education minister, Barbara Nowacka, is a left-wing atheist and pro-abortion feminist. She has started reducing the amount of classical literature and history taught in schools, while halving religious studies lessons and increasing sex education. The latter has been particularly unpopular with the socially conservative population, who, like Korvinia, a grandmother of five, long for what she calls a more backward Poland. Regardless of who wins the presidential election, which remains a close, evenly matched race, Poland's political significance in Europe is assured, thanks to its size and strategic location. While domestic politicians often stoke fears of Russia and emphasise military spending, the reality is that Poland has, in many ways, benefited from the war. Though peace is obviously preferable, a prolonged conflict is unlikely to pose any serious threat to the country. From a statistical standpoint, Poland has been on an upward trajectory for more than two decades. Since Tusk's coalition assumed power, there hasn't been a dramatic economic revival so much as a political reset, one that has made Poland more palatable to Western leaders. Whether this shift genuinely benefits the average Pole, however, is another matter.
That was Alenka Hamilton. Next, Melanie McDonough.
Try to send a parcel lately, or a letter. If it involves a trip to the post office, all I can say is, give it time. A fortnight ago, I was posting a book to a friend and took it to the nearest post office, the central City of London one. It's housed in a convenience store, handy if you want a samosa, but lacking dignity somehow. All the electronic terminals were out of action, four or five of them. The queue was patient, but prohibitively long. Thinking bad thoughts about privatisation, I made my way to the post office in Kensington Church Street, which is a proper outfit. That was closed. I tried the Kensington High Street branch, but its machines were out of action too. I gave up. The next day, I went to the big post office near Westminster. All its machines were working, and there were actual people at the desks. Feeling spoiled, I posted the parcel, and it arrived. Eventually. Four post offices, one little parcel. Then, a couple of weeks ago, I was given that thrillingly retro item, a cheque. I should have had it framed as a relic of a bygone era, but I needed the cash, so I looked up the nearest post office branch in Soho, where I was. My bank closed its branches in central London on the basis that customers could pay in cheques or cash at any post office, but when I got to the top of the queue, the assistant told me that, sorry, it didn't take cheques. However, if I made for the larger branch, about 15 minutes away, it would help. Well, I didn't have 15 minutes to spare, so I made a special trip to a big branch the following day to pay the wretched check-in. That took time. You think it's easier if you just got a letter or a card for which you've got a book of stamps? Ha and ha! You belong to the era when you could nip down the road to the nearest letterbox, from which an obliging postman would collect your letter by 5:30 p.m. or a little later if you were lucky. No longer. You have to be up early to catch a postman now, by 7 a.m. in some cases, by 9 a.m. in the rest. If you want to get your letter picked up for dispatch that very day, you're welcome to make your way to the nearest post office. Not convenient? Look, you're missing the point. No one cares. Then there's a problem of actual delivery. Before someone surfaces to tell me that buying a stamp and posting a letter and having it delivered are done by two separate entities, the post office and Royal Mail, let me say that I know, and this is precisely the problem. In the old, sane, state-owned entity, the buying of the postage stamp, right through to the delivery of the thing it was stuck on, was overseen by one body, under the control of a government minister. Since privatisation, these functions have been unnaturally separated. That's one reason why it works so badly. Last week, shareholders approved Czech billionaire Daniel Kretinsky's $3.6 billion takeover of Royal Mail's parent company. Even if you don't mind a critical bit of social infrastructure going into foreign ownership, and neither the government nor the Tories have an issue with that, you may like to note the Royal Mail's proposals for deliveries. The regulator Ofcom is suggesting the postal company should scrap second-class letter deliveries on Saturdays and reduce the service to alternate weekdays, while also lowering Royal Mail's delivery targets. Natalie Blackett's communications director explained earlier this year, "The world has changed. We're sending a third of the letters we were 20 years ago. We need to reform the postal service to protect its future and ensure it delivers for the whole of the UK. Since when did halving the frequency and efficiency of a service equate to reform? The world has changed, hasn't it? Let me tell you what hasn't changed. If you double the price of a service in 5 years and reduce it from 6 days a week to three, then demand will drop. That brings me to the other bit of the equation, the price of stamps. At the beginning of last month, the price of a first-class stamp rose to £1.70 and that of a second-class stamp to 87 pence. In 2020, a first-class stamp was 76 pence. And you wonder why people are sending fewer letters? It's not just that texting and email has made communication easier. It's that it's unaffordable for most people to post letters routinely. An entire mode of communication has been priced out of existence. Is it any surprise that young people don't know how to address an envelope? It could be because it's too expensive to send a birthday card. Recently, I've been going through archives from the last century. Caches of letters, all referring to catching the post and sending replies by return. Email isn't the only thing that has killed all that off. It's a political class who presided over the destruction of an historic service. You absolute creeps.
That was Melanie McDonough, now Hannah Moore.
I spent my childhood being ferried around in my mom's minivan, a hunter green Ford Windstar. Compared with most family cars on the road today, it was like Air Force One, magisterial and bigger than was strictly necessary. I loved that minivan. It was roomy and comfortable, with a two-seater half bench in the middle row to allow access to the full three-seater third row. The Windstar saw my two sisters and me through our primary years, to twice-weekly basketball and volleyball practice. In the summer, we would head to the lake, all the kit housed neatly in the back. Apart from the handful of times I threw up in the back seat, my memories of that van are happy ones. The multi-purpose vehicle, MPV, was commonplace in my millennial childhood. Most families had one, and I fondly remember it as a mom van. But then that was the American West, where the average street is wider than a four-lane motorway in Europe. I live in Britain now, and the age of the mom van is over, if it had ever begun. This is the age of the SUV. For reasons unclear, British drivers are besotted with them. Most family vehicles fit into this category, with the shape of a Land Rover, but the soft trim and appeal of a family car. They are sold as such in every article titled Best Family Seven-Seaters, and I have read all of them. SUVs top the list. MPVs don't feature. With baby number three on the way, I've spent weeks studying the range of family SUVs. Initially, I settled on the 2021 Hyundai Santa Fe, but when I went to see one in person, I was shocked by the impracticality of it. It was essentially unusable for a family of five. The middle row only fits two car seats, and the two rear seats are so tiny, even my six-year-old would struggle to fit. Factor in her booster seat, and it's impossible. What's more, the third row is blocked by the middle one, and when I asked the salesman how a person is supposed to get back there with two child seats in the way, he shrugged and said, "You could climb in via the back?" I imagine myself on a sodden morning, 6 months from now, dragging out the pram and the nappy bag from the boot so my eldest could tramp her muddy feet all over as she clambered into the back. The space itself is awful. Just looking at it makes me nauseous, with its tiny portholes for windows and no air vents. I'd rather be in a dog crate. At least you'd have airflow. "It has a huge boot," said the salesman, "with all the seats down. But when is a mother of three going to be traveling with no passengers?" With both rear rows in use, the boot resembles a large briefcase. It couldn't fit more than two modestly filled grocery bags. I will soon be toting a pram, a baby seat, two boosters, two school bags, and a nappy bag, as a bare minimum. Not one affordable seven-seater SUV on the market will do the job. The Santa Fe's competitors are worse. Skoda trumpets the fact that its Kodiaq has a bigger boot than the Hyundai's, but with the seats up, you're left with 340 liters. That's smaller than the boot of a Volkswagen Polo hatchback. What is the point? Why design a seven-seater that can neither comfortably carry seven people nor any reasonable amount of kit? A handful of the seven-seater SUVs sold as family vehicles have not even been crash-tested for child seats in the third row or in the middle seat of the second. That leaves only two child-friendly seats if you exclude the front passenger. For a mother of three-plus, this rules these vehicles out entirely. Like the 4x4s they're modeled on, the family SUV is designed for off-roading, not for transporting babies. Sports utility vehicle. The clue is in the name. People wonder why Britain's population is in decline, but consider the logistical obstacles large families face. Without a big enough car, we are effectively prevented from taking part in everyday life. Older relatives remind me that, back in their day, parents just shoved the kids in the back of the old banger when they needed to. But a generation ago, large families didn't travel much. They didn't have swimming lessons to get to, or football on the weekends. Which is why I still believe that MPVs are the only sensible option. The Volkswagen Touran has five ISOFIX points for affixing car seats, so the kids can easily fit anywhere except the driver's seat. The Volkswagen Charan and the Seat Alhambra are even bigger, and, bonus, come with sliding doors. But those were discontinued 5 years ago to make room for newer, cleaner models, says Volkswagen. If you want a low-mileage Alhambra, you're running out of time to buy one. I know diesel isn't the way forward. I hate diesel. I owned a used diesel, Volkswagen Charan, which I bought 4 years ago in anticipation of having more than two children. But it broke down irrevocably on a trip to Wales on the M40 outside Leamington Spa. I didn't drive it hard enough to burn off the fumes, and the filter clogged. But moms don't need a high-powered diesel engine. They just need a car big enough to ferry their kids around. If you're looking for a petrol or hybrid minivan, your choices shrink to about three. The Ford S-Max is popular, but scores poorly in some reliability tests. Car Expert gives the 2015 to 2024 model a rating of just 28%. And according to a 2022 car buyer report, 21% of owners reported a fault in the first year of ownership, with an average repair bill of more than £900. The Citroën Grand C4 Picasso is large and comfortable, but it's French, so also a no. The only affordable petrol minivan with top safety features is the Touran, which could be described as unstylish. But I don't care. It ticks all the boxes, and it's the only one that does. I rang my local Volkswagen dealership asking to test drive a Touran, and the salesman who answered laughed and said, "Good luck finding one of those." I asked why, and he confirmed my suspicions. No one wants an MPV anymore. Everyone who might have bought one 10 years ago now buys an SUV. And so my search for a mom van continues. I will spend the time before my third child arrives scouring Auto Trader and every dealership within 100 miles for the Holy Grail, a 7-seater that actually seats 7. If you don't have 3 or more kids, you may not mourn the death of the MPV. But as I cross the threshold from 2 to 3, I certainly do.
That was Hannah Moore. And next, James Dellingpole.
Antonin Carême was known as the chef of kings and the king of chefs. His patrons and employers included Talleyrand, Napoleon, the Prince Regent, Tsar Alexander, and the then richest man in France, James Rothschild. He popularised the tall toque hat worn by chefs. He either invented or perfected culinary classics including the vol-au-vent, the profiterole and the millefeuille, as well as sauces including velouté and béchamel. All this he managed to achieve despite having come from a desperately poor background, raised in a shack in revolutionary France and sent off as a young lad to help make ends meet as a kitchen boy and later as apprentice to Paris's best pâtissier. A fascinating rags-to-riches story, you might think, but it's not one that the new Apple TV Plus series Carême is much interested in telling. It is obvious when you watch it that it is not a documentary, says Ian Kelly, who helped adapt the screenplay from his 2003 biography, Cooking for Kings. Oh, indeed it is obvious. So many liberties does this seamy potboiler take with the chef's biography, so many implausibilities does it rudely thrust into Carême's lived experience, that by the end of the first episode I wondered if a single detail was accurate. I almost began to doubt whether he'd even been a chef. Take, for example, its portrayal of his relationship with Napoleon. In real life, this consisted of his being asked to cook at Napoleon's wedding to his second wife, Marie-Louise of Austria, in 1810. But in the TV version, they meet in the 1790s when Napoleon, then only first consul, almost dies as a result of an over-exuberant bout of shagging. Luckily, Napoleon's quick-witted black servant thinks to summon Carême, having somehow intuited correctly that the chef will whip up a herbal potion on the spot that will magically revive the future emperor. As a result of this fantastical event, which never happened, not in a million years, Napoleon is understandably anxious to secure Carême's services as a chef. When Carême refuses, Napoleon has him arrested on trumped-up charges, but not before Carême has grasped that he should seek out a mysterious man named Talleyrand. Using his renowned savoir-faire and insight, Talleyrand treats Carême to some choice advice befitting his many years as a top negotiator and diplomat. Carême should go and work for Napoleon. Some of the dimmer viewers might well not have heard of this Talleyrand bloke, but fear not, Talleyrand is here to help. Almost the first things he asks Carême is, "What do you know about me?" This gives Carême the perfect opportunity to fill us in on the details, and very soon we will see Talleyrand's legendary scheming skills in action for ourselves. Show, not tell, don't you know? This occurs during yet another deeply plausible scene in which Talleyrand, cunning old club-footed diplomat clergyman that he is, persuades Carême to sneak into Napoleon's private apartment and copy a map of the route his carriage will be taking in a few days. Carême achieves this by first administering oral sex to Josephine's lady-in-waiting and then by reducing Josephine herself almost to the point of orgasm with his delicious vol-au-vent. You fear he might end up having sex with her too, but it's okay, you're safe. The Volovans are drugged, so all he has to do is put her to sleep, but not apparently in such a way as she minds or that there are any comebacks. I could go on, but I think you get the idea. Perhaps the Bridgerton crowd will enjoy this confection of sex, bad history and nonsense, but to me it's just an opportunity wasted. Usually the great relief with foreign language drama is that it hasn't yet succumbed to annoyances like diversity casting, anachronistic haircuts and intelligence-insulting plot lines, but this is so bad it might as well be American and on Netflix. Still, the food looks good and Benjamin Voisin makes a handsome, dashing Carême. And I guess I'm quite looking forward to the inevitable scene where Carême turns the course of the Battle of Waterloo by delaying the arrival of the Prussians by covering their path with exquisitely crafted lengths of blancmange shaped to look like frankfurters. Chef's Table, Legends on Netflix might be better if it weren't so stiltedly hagiographical and earnest. I watched the episode on Alice Waters, whose Berkeley, California restaurant Chez Panisse pioneered the farm-to-fork movement, which places more emphasis on the sourcing of ingredients than it does on technique. So, when you go there, it costs around $175 per head. Is it mainly for the warm glow of smug worthiness you get from chomping through the choicest hand-picked vegetables prettily arranged? Or is there any actual value added by the chefs? I was quite curious to know, but the documentary was more interested in telling us how Waters had changed the eating habits of America, which I'm not altogether convinced, barring the odd Silicon Valley tech billionaire, she really has.
That was James Dellingpole, and finally, William Atkinson.
Ringo Starr is mostly known as the second or third best drummer in the Beatles, but for me, as for many children of the past four decades, he will forever be the voice of Thomas the Tank Engine. This week marks 80 years since the publication of The Three Railway Engines, the first book in the Reverend Wilbert Audrey's Railway series. The series is based on stories Audrey told to cheer up his son Christopher, who was recovering from measles. More than 40 books followed, alongside the television programme, films, theme parks and toys. Together, the franchise has been valued at more than £1.2 billion. Despite its success, Audrey's world has been condemned as authoritarian and reactionary. In 2009, University of Alberta professor accused Thomas of pushing a conservative ideology and relegating female characters to the back of the train. Others have called him sinister, repressive, and imperialist. A shadow transport minister once blamed the books for a lack of female train drivers, calling it a national scandal. As these are rather silly comments, there is something conservative about Thomas. The engines puff around in constant competition, and failure to follow the rules results in misfortune, derailment, or punishment by the Fat Controller. In the first book, the engine Henry is bricked up in a tunnel for refusing to work because he's worried about damaging his paint job. Henry earns his freedom by helping another engine that breaks down, learning his lesson and once again becoming a really useful engine. Order with a chance of redemption, just as one would hope from a book written by a vicar. The English have a particular affection for railways, and Audrey captures the romance of train travel as poetically as the Whitsun weddings or the paintings of Eric Revellius. Thomas exists in a pre-beaching world, the green and pleasant land of Sodor, punctuated by the puff-puff and toot-toot of trains that were already dated by the book's publication. Audrey was writing at the same time as J.R.R. Tolkien, and both share an unmistakable disdain for the brave new world of post-war Britain. The announcement of rail nationalisation in the third book comes with a noticeable twinge of regret. Travelling to work on the tube today is as far from Thomas as one can get. Tatty seats on dirty trains, populated by oddballs, rubbish everywhere, and tourists unable to grasp standing on the right-hand side of the escalator. Around 4% of underground journeys involve some form of fare evasion. Today's dead-eyed Fat Controllers stand idly by as people push through the barriers. Thomas, too, has changed for the worse in the most recent TV adaptation. Starr's Merseyside lilt is gone, as of the quaint stop-motion models of the original. Instead, they have been replaced by CGI and an ever-expanding cast of trains with more merchandising potential. Children now have Nia, the colourful engine from Kenya, Hong Mei from China, and Chirabala, a female railway controller from India. Even though some of Audrey's original charm has been obscured, many of the traditional values still survive. This perhaps explains why Thomas the Tank Engine continues to be so popular. children tend to have a strong sense of natural justice and a hankering for fairness and rules, much like the Fat Controller.
And that's everything for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate, review, and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Petra Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.